האוניברסיטה, מרכז האודיו של אוניברסיטת רייכמן.
מפגשים מהסוג החיובי עם עדי פלד ונטלי סמסון ממרכז מיטיב לפסיכולוגיה חיובית.
שלום נטלי סמסון.
שלום עדי פלד. אנחנו מפגשים מהסוג החיובי, והיום יש לפנינו פרק מיוחד שיוקלט כולו באנגלית, שכן האורח שלנו היום הינו דובר אנגלית. Welcome to Positive Encounters, the podcast by Mative Center for Positive Psychology. As you can hear, today we have a special episode recorded in English. We are recorded at Audioversity, Reichman University's Audio Center. In this podcast, we meet Israelis from all walks of life for intimate conversations rooted in deep, open-hearted curiosity. Our wish is to create connection, foster a sense of closeness, and contribute to restoring hope. Our conversations are guided by the spirit of positive psychology. Through thoughtful questions, we create opportunities to connect more deeply with our guests, and for them to connect more deeply with themselves. Together with our guests, we invite you, our listeners, to discover the story of each individual, and through that story, uncover what is captivating, thought-provoking, and ultimately what brings us closer together.
My favorite movie is Big with Tom Hanks. If you haven't seen it, you should. It talks about a kid who goes to a carnival and asks a fortune-telling machine called the Zoltar machine for a wish to be big. Next morning, he wakes up as an adult. In great fear, he runs off to the big city of New York, where he's searching for that Zoltar machine so he could wish again and go back to being a kid. Until he finds it, he needs to handle being an adult with the pleasures and challenges of adulthood, including work, independence, and romance. Watching this film made me think that it's possible to make it in the big city. Even if you come with nothing at all, you can make it to the limelight or to a trampoline in a loft. My dream for years was to live in New York. The excuse I found for it was to do my master's degree there in Baruch College, CUNY University. When I arrived, I had to find a job. My visa allowed me to work only in the university, so I searched there. At that time, a professor named David Sitt, who taught Psychology 101, was looking for TAs for his two classes of 500 and 300 students. I offered myself for the job and was lucky enough to get it. I remember myself running through the hallways of the university from my cubicle to David's office time and again with the yearning to do a very good job and succeed, just like Tom Hanks was running in the hallways of Macmillan's Toys, the toy company where he quickly became very successful. David and I got to know each other. We realized we were both Jewish, born in the same year, 1977. We are both connected to spirituality, and we hit it off. David saw in me and showed me everything that I was. He believed in me, highlighted my strengths, and shared his stage with me. I suddenly realized that the real purpose of me coming to New York was to find my calling to be a lecturer, and I learned from the very best, him. We became good friends, work partners. I would often come with the idea, and David was and still is the executor. We did great things together, like teaching huge classes together. We conducted a flash mob with our students on 23rd Street with the mission of bringing good energies to the streets of Manhattan. We led a club for good deeds with our students, and we even began doing podcasts when no one even knew what those were. After all that, he introduced me to Dr. Tal Ben-Shachar, a moment that changed my path and my career. This all happened 17 years ago. We've been friends ever since. We meet every now and again in New York, and when he told me he's coming to do his firstborn child's bar mitzvah in Israel, I saw it as a great opportunity to do another big thing together and invited him to this podcast. David Sitt, a tenured professor at Baruch College, City University of New York, a clinical psychologist who specializes in treating adults with ADHD, and a sex therapist, an amazing teacher and a lecturer, married to Ayla, and together they have four children, and my good friend. Thank you for coming, Professor David Sitt. So glad to have you here.
Welcome, David.
וואו, מעולה. זה יפה עוד. אז מדברים באנגלית, אז אני לא אדבר בעברית, בגלל שאני לא יכול כל כך טוב, אז thank you for switching it up, and to all of our listeners, for being open-minded, because open-mindedness is awesome. For us to have this conversation, thank you for the welcome.
So it's nice. You spoke a bit of Hebrew, and we heard you, and we will speak our English, which is not our mother tongue. And so that's why we will probably speak slower than we usually do. But we will try to be as good as we are in Hebrew, but in English.
Indeed.
Okay.
So our first question would be, it's taken from Arthur Aaron, a psychologist, which actually, we start with that question every time. Almost every time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so we're going to ask you to tell us your life story in 4 minutes, in as much detail as possible.
Okay. I'm taking time and you're taking time as well.
Wow. Okay.
Let's go.
So it begins before I was born, I guess, to give quick context. I was born into a Sephardic Syrian Jewish family. My father was born in Halab in Syria, in Aleppo. And in the year 1932, actually at 16 years old, came here to Israel and was here for a few years, was in Sahel for 2 or 3 years, and came to America. He met my mother, who was also of Syrian descent. Her parents had actually come to America from Syria in the 1890s. Oh. Her grandfather, was one of the first to come over from Syria over to New York and establish the New York Syrian community. And they met my mother and father and got married and had 4 children. I'm the 4th of the 4 children. The youngest. I have so the year I was born, as Adi mentioned before, was 1977. When people meet me and they hear of my birthday, it's often an eyebrow raiser. So I'll mention that within my 4 minutes. The year was 1977. I was born in the month of July. We're just about a week away, actually, from my birthday, which is July 7th. Mm. So we put those together.
7-7-77,
which all my life presented me with this question of is that meaningful or is it chance?
Yeah, sure it is.
It's a pretty interesting roll of the dice to land on these numbers as a birth date. It happens to be my oldest brother. I said we're 4 children. My oldest brother was also born on July 7th. Mm. My son, who I'm here to celebrate his bar mitzvah, it's his birthday. Today is June 30th. He was actually due on July 7th.
Wow.
His brit milah, because he was born a week early, was on July 7th. Mm. So we have a lot of these numbers rolling around. And getting back to my 4-minute story, so I'm the one of four. My oldest brother is 15 years older. I have a brother who's 13 years older than I am and a sister who is 9 years older than I am. My sister had passed when she was 39 years old. That's a whole nother story and its impact on my life. I was 12 years old at the time. And growing up in Boston, I was born in Brookline, Massachusetts, moved to New Jersey. From New Jersey, I moved to Brooklyn and grew up in the Syrian community of Brooklyn. Went to Yeshiva Flappish, which is a prominent school in New York. Went to Baruch College as an undergraduate. Found my way towards psychology as a fluke. I thought I would be a businessman like many people in my community, but was inspired by a professor. Her name is Dr. Susan Locke. Decided to try that as a journey and went into psychology. Went to graduate school, finished graduate school in 2005. And learned I had ADHD around that time. That became an interest of mine. We could talk about it if we do. I put a lot of energy into figuring out ADHD. How am I doing on time? I don't know.
You have 45 more seconds.
Oh, good. So ADHD became an interest of mine. I started doing my clinical work in that area. Found my way to the university teaching happenstance. I think I was 22 years old when I started my role as a professor. It's over 25 years now. Got married, got divorced, got married again to my amazing wife, Ayla, and we have 4 children. And it's been a great journey. Today, I serve in a lot of different roles, wear a lot of different hats, clinical psychologist, doing work in ADHD, sex therapy is a new one. I'm the chief clinical officer of a startup with two Israeli co-founders at a company called Agave Health. And me and my wife also conduct therapy. That's a bit about me in 4 minutes.
Very good, David. Mm. Very good. You know, impressive. I totally forgot about this first marriage.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. It was early on. When was it?
I was 28 when we got married. It was a 2.5 year journey. Definitely presented a lot of challenges in terms of understanding relationships and when the marriage wasn't working and working through that and coming out of that was its own deep learning. It actually triggered a lot of opening up for me. Because out of pain and out of struggles, very often, you know, out of darkness can come light. So it was quite a time.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. You know, David, our podcast, like I said, and I say it every episode, is opening with the word saying we're interviewing Israelis. So we were wondering whether this is
legit.
Okay. Yeah.
Whether it's legit.
Since you're not Israeli.
Right.
Yet, at the same time, you have a deep connection to Israel and you represent a large part of the Jewish world. You know, Jewish people who don't live in Israel yet feel a profound emotional connection to this place. And we want to ask you, how is it, you know, being Jewish in New York, being a Syrian Jew in New York these days? It's interesting.
Yeah. I'll start by a commentary about terminology, which is something that I do give thought to. So we say Israeli. Are you Israeli or not Israeli? Are you Jewish or Israeli? What is the difference? Is it the same? In my mind, I am of a tribe of Bnei Yisrael. I'm of the children of Israel, of Jacob, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham, as our story goes, the children of the book. And I'm of the children of the book. I'm of Bnei Yisrael, very clearly. Yeah. So today we say, you know, Israeli means you live in the Eretz. You live in Eretz Yisrael, so we call you Israeli. Yeah. That's a title. It's a label. It's a label.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were we called before 1948? Did you call yourself an Israeli if you lived in the land? I don't know what the term was that we used then.
Palestinian.
Yeah. Were we? Did we call someone who was Jewish Palestinian? I don't know if that's true. I don't think that's accurate. Mm-hmm. So I am of the nation. First we were a family, right? We were a family. Then we were a tribe. From being a tribe, we became a people. From being a people, we became a nation. Religion and guidance and guidelines came afterwards, along the way, infused into it after we were a people. Mm-hmm. And I think that was part of it. And the land of Israel was always a part of our connection to each other. And so, yes, I am of the children of Israel. I live in New York. People ask me, where are you from? I say, I'm from around the whole world. Because just like my other fellow tribe members, we are dispersed all over this globe.
True.
Which is a very special part of our tribe.
Okay.
So that's a bit of my thoughts.
Yeah.
And how is it to be a Jewish, a Syrian Jew, man, these days, after October 7th, after everything happened, after I don't know how to say it, but I think the notion to Israel is not that great anywhere around the world right now. So how is it to be there? You've been there all your life. How is it to be there now? Is it any different?
Speaking, I could only speak from my experience.
Sure.
But and it's an important question to ask, and there are many, you know, what's interesting in the diaspora world is that the voice of many influencers, quote unquote, in social media, we're hearing from many people from their experience as a diaspora Jew. Mm-hmm. And it's great, right? I'm a big fan of a particular podcast by Dan Senor called Call Me Back.
Okay.
And he brings in a lot of people to share this perspective. From my perspective, it is a different time. The temperature has shifted, most certainly. We do walk around in New York. I walk around in New York to a degree a bit more cognizant, hypervigilant.
Mm. What does it mean?
Hypervigilant means I'm more aware, I'm more vigilant of my surroundings, likely because my brain, which has a fight or flight survival at its core, by design, mm-hmm. is scanning the environment for danger.
Do you feel the environment is more dangerous?
It's not dangerous to me in a physical sense, mm-hmm. as much as it is in an existential sense.
Although
I do honestly believe I'm not worried about my ultimate existence or of our existence as a mm-hmm. people. We are in a difficult period. There is a lot of pressure. There's a lot of attention. There's a lot of politics. World stage is certainly focused towards Israel, mm-hmm. and as an extension, the Jewish people.
Yeah.
So it is. There is more. And unfortunately, there's more awareness, but it's the problem is that there's a lot of misawareness, misinformation driving through technological, algorithmic designs, tremendous misinformation.
Yeah.
And that causes a big problem for us, unfortunately. So,
for example?
So, for example, a friend of mine was telling me a story the other day where they were in New York and someone turned to them. To their friend, he is an Israeli friend of mine. There was two people on a university in Washington Square Park.
Mm-hmm.
One of these individuals turns to another one and says, "Bro, I just ran into this Jewish guy the other day, and I yelled at him. I yelled at him, and I called him a slur." And they high fived each other. And this friend of mine was Israeli, right? Active in Miluim. He said, "I wanted to just step into that." But I didn't. I chose not to. But that was intense because they didn't even understand, right? And I give other examples. I have friends. There's a lot of examples whereby there is a misinformation, misunderstanding, and we could elaborate. It could take us all the time. But I think our audience understands.
Yeah. How does it feel to be you're far away, but you're very deeply connected to Israel? And when something as huge as October 7th happens, we know how it felt for us being Israeli citizens here. How is it when you're far away?
I remember very distinctly where I was when I heard the news of what was occurring on October 7th. I was walking into synagogue. It was on Simchat Torah because we had the second days. We have an extra day. I walked into it was the same day I walked in to synagogue and someone ran up to us and told us the news. And everybody in the building in the synagogue that I was in at the time in New Jersey, we were gripped with not fear, but worry and concern. And as if we were one body and we felt, the body, the torso was taking a big challenge here in Israel, and we were feeling it. Maybe we were further away, but the body felt it. Yeah. And we continue to feel that. I continue to feel that. And I speak to my friends like Adi and many other of my other friends here. And that's how I check in on what's happening on the ground. And we feel it. And my friend Eve Maman, my co-founder at Agave, she lives here in Tel Aviv. I was checking in on her regularly. How are you doing? Where are you? How are your children? How are you dealing with the difficulty? Even knowing that I have a little bit more safety, a lot more safety perhaps in some ways, but we feel it and I continue to.
Yeah.
David, Israel is like a home base for all Jews around the world. And when you see that there are missiles headed to Israel, that soldiers are being killed, that citizens are being bombed and losing their houses, hostages being tortured, you see it from afar. What does it do to you?
I'm going to first explain, I am somebody who, I'm an emotional person by design. Adi, you were speaking my introduction. I was tearing. I cry easily. I have senses of emotions. I pick up people, read people. It's part of the way my brain is designed. So I feel suffering and pain of people in general. When I was in India for 2 months traveling and I met the poverty and I saw the suffering, I feel it. So already I'm attuned. When it's my own body, my own extension, it felt very difficult. At the same time, I'm in a university. I'm a professor. Baruch College, where I teach, is the most ethnically and culturally diverse school, arguably, in America.
Yeah.
Wow.
We have 185 languages spoken on campus, represented by our student body. It's a very diverse group. And my role is not to be political, at least as I interpret my role. I'm a professor of psychology. Yeah. I'm there to teach. I'm there to educate. And so I wasn't a professor like others professors on your campuses who made it their mission to be vocal and fight against. I didn't take that path consciously. And so while I felt the pain and daily, and I was glued to the news and reading, I also had to maintain my professional, I chose to maintain a role of maintain my professional roles. I'm a therapist, for example. I had clients who were engaging in things that were very, I knew in my therapy, they were very clearly pro, different than what I believe in.
And still they came to you. I mean, it's visible that you're Jewish, right?
You wear a kippah sometimes or a hat sometimes. Yeah.
I do cover my head consciously. I don't think that my public persona profile is necessarily screaming, I am a Jewish mm-hmm. therapist or I am a Jewish professor. I don't hide anything, of course. But maybe people might know. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, I'm open about everything in my life. So yes, these yeah. clients do know, and they might be able to understand my political thinkings. And yet, yeah. yes, they still were working with me.
Yeah, they're not very concerned about that. they come to.
Well, that's my role. My role, yeah. I believe, in that role, I'm a man of many hats, as I often say. So in the role of a therapist, I position myself in a certain mindset to yeah. play that role. As a professor, I wear a different hat. As a parent, what I say at home to my own children, my own family, or what I speak about in my synagogue or in my public, you know, my chesed work that I do, each space that I'm in, there's a slight yeah. adjustment that happens.
Are students trying you out? Are they trying you out? Are they asking something that has to do with your religion or anything? Because you have tons of students.
I did not have many students in my classes. And yes, I have 450 students in one classroom. I have graduate students, 30 students in a graduate cognitive behavioral therapy class in another room, a positive psychology course with 20 students. And my students, I believe I set a tone of we're here for this education. And maybe there was one or two occasions where not really even directed at me, but directed towards each other because things were hot on the campus.
Yeah.
We had a swastika put on the campus. At Baruch, when you walk in, someone spray painted a slur on the granite.
Really?
Yeah, it's still till today. They washed it out, but you can still see the wow. You know, so there were events happening on campus. There were a lot of events happening on campus. But in my room, in my classroom, it wasn't something that came up much.
Yeah. You told us that now, during your visit, you went with your whole family to, you volunteered in preparing meals for soldiers.
Yes, yes.
How did you decide to do that? What was the idea?
Immediately after, chesed is a part of our life. Yeah. You know, again, I'm born into a community, into a family, my mother, my father, and my grandparents, my cousin. We're very chesed oriented and tzedakah oriented. And, you know, especially the Halabi community, I don't know if it's the same way here, but certainly in New York, we are very much educated on giving and providing. And chesed is just such a critical part of our thinking. So we're always oriented that way. October 7th occurred. Our community, my wife, Ayla, was here within, I think, 3 weeks yeah. or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
She came here in December on a mission. She flew here with 40 others, with my mother-in-law, and came and did anything that they could to help support the country. Yeah. And so we believe in this. So when we came for the bar mitzvah, it was critical for us to make sure to incorporate chesed for my children to see and understand. And we went to one chesed is the name of the organization. We went to their location. We cooked 60 pizzas. We delivered it to one of the bases in the area. And the soldiers were engaging and they were so grateful. And we were singing and we were dancing and we were talking. And it was powerful for us and for them. It happened for both. So, you know, we made sure to include that in our time here.
How's your trip? I mean, you've been here for the past 2 weeks, I think. How was your trip here in Israel? How do you feel, Israel? You've been here many times.
Yes, yes. I actually studied here in university, Behar Tzofim.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You know,
it wasn't for too long, right?
6 months.
Okay.
Right. It wasn't that good. My Hebrew's not that great.
6 months? You have good Hebrew for
months.
6 months.
Well, I also went to a yeshiva in New York.
Okay.
Yeshiva of Lapash. We learned Hebrew.
Yeah.
My children speak fairly decent. They understand fluently Hebrew at young ages. Our school is very medayek on this. So, but anyway, going back to the question, how's our trip?
Yeah.
We weren't sure we were going to even make it here.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of the way we live for the last
3 years.
Two and a half years. Yeah.
Right. Right.
We're not sure it's going to happen.
Yes. Right. Are we showing up to work tomorrow?
Yeah.
Right. Are our kids going to school tomorrow?
Yeah.
That's the big question.
Let's see.
Yeah. Maybe.
So we told ourselves, we decided, we were going to be about 40 people coming from my family, cousins, brother-in-laws. Yeah, and many people weren't able to stay committed. We booked flights and we said, if El Al is flying, we're flying. That was the stance we took. And that's what happened. So El Al was flying. We got on the plane and we arrived. And it's been incredible. The trip has been amazing. We feel the deep love of people of Israel, of the land of Israel, of the Ruach that's here, of the Meshugah that's here, of the... It's amazing. I don't think there's anywhere in the world that's quite like being here, and it's been awesome.
Can you tell me something about maybe the highlight of the trip up until now?
The single highlight?
Yeah, one.
If I were to pick a single highlight, was the Bar Mitzvah day of my son, which... It's just been 13 years in the making, and as a parent, you hear other people's versions of their lives and what they did and what they went through and their story, and you're always like, oh, okay, I could kind of sort of maybe imagine what that would be like for me, but you don't quite know until it happens. And so this event of a bar mitzvah, you know, a life cycle event.
In the Kotel? Was it in the Kotel?
We didn't do the event. We didn't do the bar mitzvah at the Kotel. We did it by Yom Chamishi last week. We made a booking at the Chorva, Bet Knesset Chorva, Chorva Synagogue.
All right.
Which was only recently, several years ago, reopened. Mm. And it was incredible. It was incredible. We had my favorite spiritual leader or guide, Rav Yosef Dweck, was the former chief rabbi of the Sephardic and Portuguese community in London, who was from New York, California, New York. He was with us. That was very special for us. And so that day was just incredible. My son read from the Torah. He's a chazan. He's only he's 13, but he has chazanut. He knows the makam. Anyone who's out there knows the Sephardic or Chalabi makam, and he's learning it. And it was just so cool. Just so cool to see this little dude become a little man and be out there. And the family celebrating and our Israeli friends. It was so Israel. We were at the breakfast afterwards and walking by, there was two different groups of people who we know, who didn't even know we were here, that saw us and just came up, say, oh, you're here. What are you? And just, it was just family. It was
a lot of love.
Family.
Yeah.
A lot of love.
And Ezra, your son, he's a blonde little guy with blue eyes. Just an amazing guy. Beautiful. I saw him last night. And also, we should say, you know, people do not see this podcast, so they don't see who's this David.
Right.
And so I will just say that he's sitting in front of us. Blue eyes. I love your blue eyes, David. This beard that was not shaved. A kippah on the head, just because he didn't have a hat today. But if he would have a hat, he would bring the hat. Mm-hmm. And if we had the right sunglasses that he can see through them, he would probably put them on. He's just wearing black and white today, but usually he's very, very colorful.
It's actually a navy blue, I think.
Yes, is it?
Yeah.
It might be. And a necklace with a round stone around the neck. So this is the guy who's sitting in front of us. David, something very special about you is that you are an amazing teacher and you are an amazing lecturer. And it's not an everyday thing that a person has 500 students in his class, 300 students in his class, all in the same semester. What makes you such a good teacher? What makes you such a good lecturer in your eyes?
becoming someone who can to become a teacher or a professor was not my goal in life. I would be very, you know, my journey, many aspects of it weren't things I chose. There were elements that the universe connected me to, and likely because there was aspects of my spirit and of my soul that were designed for that experience. Teaching and more than teaching, being able to connect with people in mass and in large kind of groups is something that I naturally enjoy, and my mind is able to think about the other people in that room, and not just as single individuals, but also a group. So a different example of how I interact is when I'm at a good party.
Okay.
I love to dance, Adi, you know.
I know.
Flash mob was a part of that.
Right.
Thing,
yeah. I love to dance. I love good energy. And I like to stimulate and create waves of energy. And so, for example, I might be somewhere where there's a crowd and there's music, and I could be that one who senses the vibe, starts to move, starts to clap, starts to move the energy, and suddenly, before you know it, people are dancing. There's a dance happening. There's a movement happening. And energy spreads, and joy and positivity and fills the space, and it's an uplifting experience for all of us in that room. Teaching, for me, is a version of that. I really enjoy teaching in large rooms because there's an energy.
Beautiful.
That's so cool. And I enjoy intellectual discourse. I enjoy challenging people to be open-minded. I enjoy being challenged in return. And I try to be humble when I am serving in that role, because I don't know everything. I'm not the smartest guy in the room. I'm not by far. I'm average run-of-the-mill person. I'm good at what I do.
You are.
But it's the humility, you know, counterweight, I think, is a critical role of being a good educator and teacher. So I'll pause with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. You know, recording this podcast in English is quite a step outside of our comfort zone. And I was thinking about this stepping out of the comfort zone, which you must have something to say about that. You're a psychologist. You're a person living in this world. You have ADHD. So what can you say about stepping out of the comfort zone?
Being aware of what's comfortable is autopilot. Mm-hmm. We're operating on autopilot. The way our brains work is that the way I see it, we consider what was yesterday, how I engaged in the world yesterday, and my brain assumes I'm going to repeat because it's comfortable, it's easier, it's more predictable, and therefore I'm going to travel in that direction of what's comfortable. Getting out of your comfort zone is turning off that comfort and turning off the autopilot and being willing to go with the bumps, go with the unpredictable, and be open, because openness is critical to new opportunities. I used to talk about LMNOP, to live, I'm doing this quickly, live mindfully. You notice when you're living mindfully, you can notice a lot more because you're attuning and noticing. And once you notice more, opportunities present themselves to you. Mm-hmm. LMNOP. And once you have that awareness and opportunities, you could proceed forward with great accomplishment and beauty can come out. So,
Can you think of one example of you stepping out of the comfort zone and revealing this great opportunity that you took?
This recent stepping out of a comfort zone, sometimes it's there's small comfort zones, like meeting somebody who you don't know is going to like you, right? You're worried about the interaction, and being willing to open yourself up, mm-hmm. right? And be exposed in that engagement. For me, I've mentioned this other opportunity that I took on recently over the past 3 years as this co-founder and chief clinical officer. That was out of my comfort zone, taking on that role, going into a startup company, taking on risk of managing many, 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 many therapists and coaches and a growing business that is not what I've been doing in the past was very much out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
But the excitement and the adrenaline of it to me is what allows me to keep going, keep putting the next foot forward.
You know, Andre Gide, he's a writer. He said, "Men cannot discover new oceans unless he has the courage to lose sight of the shore." So I guess until we move out of our comfort zone, we don't grow, we don't develop. Everything happens when we move out. Must say that I had this thing. I go swimming in the morning and 6 a.m. and there is a group. There's a group of old men who are swimming in the pool. And I went and I get there and I see that, you know, the third line is free and I want to go in. And then this guy comes to me and he says, there's an order here. Mm. And I'm like, what? I mean, did you buy the pool? I mean, what? He says, I always swim here. And I said, okay, so today you can swim in another line, you know, or I don't know. And he's like, no, you can't swim in my line, whatever, whatever. Finally, I went to another line and I swam there. And then a couple of days later, I came again. And again, I want to go to the third line. That's how you say the line? Yeah.
Lane.
I go to the third lane and he comes again. And he speaks to me, and this time I decided not to answer, and I just went in and started swimming. And then we met in the sauna afterwards, and he said to me, "You didn't speak to me today." And I said, "Yeah, I had nothing to say, but was it so bad swimming next to me?" And he said, "No, actually, it was really okay. And I swim, and I try not to bother anyone." And I said, "I also try not to bother anyone. It was really nice swimming next to you." Finally, we hit it off. We started talking. He's like a 65-year-old man. We really hit it off. And I said to him, "You know, maybe you should try even once to go to another lane." And he said, "Why?" I said, and I told him the sentence by Andre Gide. And he said, "You know, my wife tells me this for 30 years. And I said, maybe it's a good time to start listening to her.
Yeah.
Or change a wife, which will probably not happen if he doesn't change a lane.
I tried that. I did the change the wife move. It was,
sometimes it worked out.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when you asked me the question, my real internal reaction was, I am very comfortable being uncomfortable. I do it easily. I like to be out of my comfort zone. And so it was hard for me to even pull up a real example of pushing myself out of a comfort zone. But then as you've been speaking, Eddie, I realized for me, a true out of the comfort zone challenge that I've taken on most recently, you mentioned it early in the introduction, was the sex therapy.
Yeah, that's what I thought
path.
About. Yeah.
Why? Why is it out of your comfort zone?
Well,
I mean, sex, David.
Well, so sex as a topic to talk about is something in my comfort zone. And as a therapist, I have always spoken and asked about people's sexual history and tried to pull out certain elements, whether it be about masturbation or pornography or infidelity or variations of sexual interests and proclivities. So it's always been comfortable. And Ayla, because of that, my wife Ayla, Dr. Ayla, she's also a clinical psychologist, good to know because she is in the same space as me, said to me, "David, I think it's time that you push yourself out of your comfort zone. I know you do talk about sex with clients, but you're not really trained yet in what to do with that knowledge and how to really work with someone deeply, not as a side part of your ADHD or anxiety or depression work, which I'm very comfortable with, as a focal point. And I said, you know, it's time that I put myself through a new training. And I committed to do a very intensive series of sex therapy and sex courses and training. And I'm still in the middle of it. And I started supervision with an Israeli supervisor from Israel. We meet on Israel time. And she's teaching me tremendous amount of information. And it's very much out of my comfort zone. Mm. But I'm getting comfortable.
You started treating people with
I have started to. I have some clients that I already have been working with. And now it just coincided that, being that I've been taking the course, I've been sitting through it for almost 6 months.
Yeah.
I opened the door up to, and I asked more about it. And so I have clients that I'm going to be doing more focused work.
That's very interesting.
It is.
I mean, I wonder what's different about it. I mean,
well, there's a lot.
What's new about it for you?
There's a lot. It's not, sex therapy is an umbrella term. We may talk about masturbation or, you know, I gave you some examples, but you also might talk about what we now call minor attraction. Minor attraction is a nouveau term for pedophilia. People that have sexual attraction towards children. Mm. So let's say you have a client who brings that to you and tells you their stories about how they enjoy having sex with a minor, with an 8-year-old. How does a therapist put their brain into a place where they can separate and understand? It is a very deep challenge.
Wow.
To understand the humanity of that person and where to work with them. And maybe you have there's so many other layers of work. I know you told me someone came on the show that went through a transition,
yeah.
Right? So that's deep work. I had a client that went through a transition and were transgendered, and they decided to do the therapy and do the hormone treatment. And that was like years ago. I wasn't trained in that. We didn't work on that in graduate school. It's not anything like anyone else that I've worked with clinically, and I'm responsible to help move them through that journey responsibly without judgment, right? Without making them feel one way or the other, you know, negative. That is not an easy thing to go through, and you have to check your own transferences, my own emotions.
Yeah, and all of the time.
It's a lot of work, you know, as a therapist.
It's a level of a deep, deep listening. It's a whole different section of listening. It's a whole different thing, and it's fascinating to hear you speak about the way you develop in this field. It's really interesting.
You know, we just spoke about on the way here, we spoke about Michael Jackson and how we love him as an artist, and all the news about the pedophilia, etc., did it change how, you know, our love to his music? And it's a thing, because I met those two kids, 11 years old, like 2 weeks ago, and they love Michael Jackson. They just love him. And then we sat in a group, like 10 of them. And then one kid said, you know, he's a pedophile. And those two that are just, they love him, they couldn't handle it. They didn't know what to do with it. On the one hand, they loved his music. On the other hand, what do I do with this information? Can I still love his music, you know? Kids.
Yeah.
It's complicated. I think the fact that Michael Jackson is not alive anymore makes it a bit easier, but it's complicated.
Yeah.
I want to ask David something about ADHD. We could speak for the whole episode could be about ADHD, but can you say something about the book and
First of all, I mean, you have ADHD, David, and to work with you on the one hand was like a roller coaster. Because you're here, you're there, you're everywhere, and then on the other hand, you do so many things, and I know it hasn't been easy for you to deal with it, and then you wrote a whole book about it, about ADHD. So first of all, tell us something about you and the ADHD and how you live with it. Maybe something about the book, and maybe what's the main. I know I know there's not one, but maybe the tool that works best for you.
Beregel echad, right?
And yeah,
one foot,
right.
Give it over.
Right,
okay.
Good luck. In 3 minutes,
Evanti,
if you can.
Evanti. Okay, so firstly, the way ADHD to me is it's a way we describe a particular brain style. ADHD today, we describe it as a developmental, quote-unquote, condition. I don't like the word condition. I don't think it's the appropriate way to describe ADHD because it's a brain style. My brain, however the details of the research explains the variations in this chemical and the size of that brain structure, however it is that we continue to understand the design, it's a different brain. So just the same way you have people that have Apple operating system and some people have Windows and some people have Linux and some people, it's a different operating system. There's strengths, there's weaknesses. You have to learn how to use that operating system maximally and to increase the probability of your success with your operating system, with your brain style. So my brain is of this ADHD brain. It has challenges. I run late because my brain doesn't process time in the same way. I put things off to the very last minute. Much of that because my brain enjoys the intense rush of the adrenaline of the pressure that it, now this is the moment. And in that moment, my mind opens up with such intense creativity and clarity, which is why I love teaching, which is why I love jumping up on the stage in front of 450 students, because that's the moment. I don't prepare all the details. You know this, Adi. I woke up, and in that moment, I invent something in the moment. And I trust my ability to do that because that's my ADHD brain's superpower, as they sometimes talk about, hyper-focus. So those are some of what it's like to live with ADHD. There's good, there's bad. I could be impulsive. I could say things that hurt people's feelings because I didn't filter. I don't hold back easy enough. I don't have brakes to put onto the car. And how do I I think the question was, what is something that I could do? And I did write a book about it called ADHD Refocused. Right. It's on Amazon. I have sold a couple of books here in Israel from what my readouts tells me. Nice. I don't even really pay attention to it. But one of the things that I believe helped me in my life, because the book is really about my own personal work and academic work, was mindfulness. Developing this elemental P, this ability to live mindfully, so that we're talking about awareness. The ADHD brain struggles with awareness and directing awareness. We're here, we're in the clouds, we're distracted, we're impulsive. So what is that a function of? It's a function of my ability to move my mind and harness that. So developing awareness, mindfulness, be aware of the present moment, like we all teach in the positive psychology courses that we teach and we give over, right? Mm-hmm. That is a critical tool to helping someone with ADHD increase the probability that today, maybe I'll do a good day. I'll have a good day. And then tomorrow, it all resets. Yeah. The lights on the stage go back off. Everything goes right back down like the soundboard in front of us here. It goes down to zero. I have to start all over again.
How do you practice that?
The first element, you know, at Agave, our company, we do a lot of education. We believe that you first need to learn about it. What is this thing that we talk about, this brain? What are the elements of it? What are the proclivities? What are the styles? And then once we're learning, meditation is a great tool. And you don't have to meditate like, you know, on Dharamsala on the mountaintop for 5 hours with silence, with quiet brain. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a minute. While you're waiting for the traffic light to turn and you're on the corner, put your phone down and notice. Tell your mind, I am going to use you, mind, right now. We're going to work together to notice. That's mindfulness. That's meditation.
Right. Yeah, Richie Davidson from the University of Wisconsin, he's a brain researcher, and he says even 1 minute a day, but as long as it's 1 minute a day, that's meditation.
Yeah, I love the way you speak to your mind,
right?
It's a
dialogue.
We're going to work together,
right?
It's a relationship. It's beautiful.
It's a relationship. And by the way, technology, I write about this in my book. I've always been passionate about the role that the upcoming technology plays. One of my early, I've started and stopped many things as a good ADHD person does, like my podcast we started many years ago. And I started a blog called Dear Technology, and I would write letters. The blog was, the format was, I would write, Dear Technology, I just received the first 3G cellular phone. It is amazing. And I would write a letter to it, and it would write me back. The next week, technology would write, Dear David, and it would answer me. before AI would do that before, for us.
Yeah.
Right? But this idea of being in a relationship with technology is critical, and that is causing a lot more of what we all are feeling as ADHD. We're all a bit ADHD because of our technology.
I love it because the story you tell yourself, this is what makes the difference from victim to how do we call it in
an
English?
Active agent.
To an active agent, exactly. Mm. You're not a victim, you're an active agent. Mm. I love it. David, what's religious for you? What's spirituality for you?
Mm.
What's religion for you and what's spirituality for you?
To me, it's actually easy. Many people, you know, you mentioned earlier, like, David, you wear a kippah. Yeah. I don't wear a kippah per se because of a religious ruling that was told me I must. I understand there are religious descriptions, not only in Judaism, but in many religions, about a head covering, for example. To me, the practice is about awareness, again, mindfulness, of the reality that I believe we have a higher power, God, nature, you want to say.
Divinity,
existence with a capital E, as Rav Yosef Dweck, my one of my spiritual guides says. Hari Kaur, you remember Hari, my yoga teacher in New York, right? My Kundalini, one of my other things that I took on was Kundalini yoga. I was trained and certified and taught for many years yoga. Anyway, it's about awareness of a higher sense of things. So that spirituality to me is awareness of my spirit, that it connects to a broader, bigger, collective unconscious or non-local consciousness is a new term that I read about recently. Non-local, it's not here. It's non-local. Where is it? It's beyond the human brains, like Maimonides talked about. It's not in our brains are using brain human language, but this thing we're talking about is beyond brain human language. And all right, how do I talk about it? That's a spiritual life, is to think about that relationship. Now, religion is following a practice. It's following a guideline. We have in Judaism a great, I love it. I love Judaism. It's amazing because it has great guidelines of how to live a life and follow a derech and follow an order. Sometimes I understand it. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes there's meaning in it. Sometimes it's confusing. Sometimes I'm angry at it. Sometimes I'm grateful for it. But that's, to me, religion is following it. And there's great benefit to it, such as survival. Survival, it's a good
depends.
One.
It depends. When you're one. Jewish, sometimes it doesn't help you survive.
Well, it may not help you, but it will help your collective you
that's true.
Survive, which we've done.
And for you, does it give you order in this ADHD religion, maybe?
I wish I could be, you know, like, for example, praying every day. I value it. I can't say that I have. My son, who's bar mitzvah now, turned to me recently and said, "Dad, do you pray every day, Dad?" And I said, "Ezra, to be honest, I haven't been able to achieve that order of every day putting on my tefillin and praying. I would like to. I think it benefits me. It's healthy for me." You and I years ago sat with Ilana Rogel. We talked about the order and it is. It would be good for my ADHD brain if I could hold the line. I struggle with it, and I'm okay with that because the other thing about ADHD is self-acceptance. So mindfulness and self-acceptance are you can't stand on one foot. But regular chad is not okay. You'll fall over.
Yeah.
The second is self-acceptance.
Amazing.
Critical.
In a sentence, your hopes for Israel. Mm.
My hope for Israel is that we will continue to look inwards and understand that we are a we. We are a unit. We are a people. We are a tribe. We are a family. And that families fight with each other. We disagree with each other. We have a lot. And I hope for Israel that we will come back to always remember that we are family. And families, it's great if you can manage to stick together, even if sometimes you disagree, even if there's difficulties. We're a family. And as long as we remind ourselves of the family element of that, which predated the nationhood, and predated the modern state that we live in today, predating all of that, is a quantum, physical, spiritual, family essence. And if we can hold on to that, it might, maybe not even us, maybe it'll help our children, but it'll keep going. We'll get there. We'll keep figuring it out. We'll just keep going. Amen. Kadima.
Amen. Amen. Optimistic. That's what we needed.
Wow. Okay. So, David Seed, so good that you came to Israel and you found the time to come to meet us here in Positive Encounters. Adi, thank you for bringing David Seed to Israel.
Sure. I didn't bring him. He just came and I brought him here.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad you came and that we did it once again, David.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. תודה נטלי סמסון.
תודה עדי פלד. אנחנו מפגשים מהסוג החיובי. ניפגש בפרק הבא.
מפגשים מהסוג החיובי עם עדי פלד ונטלי סמסון, ממרכז מיטיב לפסיכולוגיה חיובית.